Hello and welcome to our national webinar, Patenting Green Technologies, Crafting Patent Claims for Clean Energy Innovations. This conference is sponsored by Stratford, a leading publisher of specialized newsletters for attorneys and tax professionals. I'm Eric Register, an attorney with Stratford's Legal Webinar Group. Now, for today's program, you can either listen to the web presentation through your computer speakers, or you can call in and listen by telephone using the dial-in instructions we sent you previously. You can switch to telephone audio at any time during the conference. And as with any webinar, the quality of your experience depends on your internet connection and the platform you're using. If you're having any problems, consult the connection instructions that we sent you and let us know so that we can help. If you're participating in the live seminar and you haven't already done so, you can access the web presentation by going to www.beaconliveweb.com. And the meeting room number that you'll need to plug in there is 9312. Your dial-in PIN also serves as your access code. And if you're listening to a recorded version of this seminar, you won't have to worry about logging into the web presentation at all. Now, after the presentations, we will conduct a live interactive question and answer session. At any time during the seminar, you may ask a question by emailing it to iplaw@stratfordpub.com. That's iplaw@stratfordpub.com. Or at any time during the seminar, you can chat your question to me by using the chat feature on the computer. At the lower left corner of the screen, you type in your question and click the blue icon beside the box, and we will receive it. And the third option you'll have is to call in and speak directly with our speakers, and I'll give you instructions on how you can do that later on. And I'd also like to remind our listeners that the handouts for today's event are posted at stratfordpub.com/products/TLU7AA/. Attendees may not record this webinar. However, Stratford will make recorded versions available for purchase. In addition, we will arrange for CLE credits for this webinar for listeners who request CLE. Now, if you want credits for New York State, be sure to listen later because I will have a code for you that you must write down to get credit, CLE credits for New York State. So there'll be more on that later. So at this time, webinar viewers should receive a notification on your screen. For CLE purposes, please let us know how many people are listening at your location by closing the notification box, typing your company name and the number of people at your location into the chat box in the lower left corner of the screen, and clicking the blue icon beside the box so that you're letting us know your company name and the number of people in attendance at your location. And just a reminder, as always, the views expressed during today's webinar are those of the speakers, not of Stratford, the speakers, firms, or clients, and are not intended to provide legal advice. So today we've gathered an authoritative panel of patent attorneys to examine key issues in writing patents related to green technology. They will discuss how to overcome obstacles in meeting the novelty and non-obviousness requirements, and they will offer strategies for accelerating the prosecution and enforcement of IP rights. Our first speaker is Dr. Michael Ward, who's a partner with Morrison Foerster in San Francisco. We also have Victor Cardona, who's a partner with Heslin, Rothenberg, Farley, and Macedi in Albany, New York. And we have Paul Davis, who is a partner with Goodwin Procter in Menlo Park, California. So, Michael, if you would, please get us started.
Thank you.
And you should have control now.
Yes, thank you. All right. Hello, everybody. I would like to talk a little bit about patenting green technologies and strategies and sort of starting off from a bigger, broader picture perspective initially. And I think it's very important, particularly with green technology companies, to establish an IP-savvy culture. And what I mean by that is making certain that the company understands the importance of IP, and that management, the scientists and engineers and the business development team are all on the same page. I think it's very important to establish a startup mentality. For those of you who work for startups or represented startups, you know how there's usually 3, 4, maybe 5 employees, and the employees wear multiple hats. And in doing so, they will do multiple tasks. A lot of times you'll have a chief scientist who's also a business development person. And when you have a company in its early stages, there's good communication because there's very few people to communicate with. So that when the IP strategy is developed, the company, everyone knows about it because all the members of the company are on board and understanding it. With a green technology company, as they start to grow and add more employees, for example, adding a business development person, often that business development person is sent out to meetings, gathering information and intelligence on various companies and competitors that are out there. But many times that new business development person is not a part of the IP circle. Their job and duties are related to business development, and that's what they're doing. And already the line of communication is broken down. So that's why I think it's very important to retain that startup mentality as companies grow, because as they grow, those lines of communication need to be maintained. And the way you do that is with education and communication. You need to communicate to the company that IP is a valuable asset, and that you need to also communicate that the company has an IP strategy, and that makes certain that the employees are aware of that IP strategy. It's also important that the company implements that strategy, puts it into place. It's also very important that the employees understanding that following that IP strategy is critical to the company's success. This is particularly important in the green technology area. So, how do we go about starting and putting this IP strategy together? Well, you start with the business strategy. Small companies and larger companies hopefully all have some sort of business plan or business strategy. That's where you have to start. From that flows the IP strategy. But you've got to start with the business strategy. So, green technology business strategy. What is the company all about? What are the products? What are your markets? Where are you going to be selling? Who are the competitors? What are your competitors' products? How can you increase your market share? I mean, these are all business ideas, but these are the go into the business strategy for a green technology company. Frankly, they go into it for any company. But that is where the IP strategy must start. You need to understand the business strategy. What is the business? What is that you're planning on selling, and where are you going to sell it? So once you have your hands around the business strategy, you can then start to put in place the IP strategy. So this slide illustrates the various forms of protection that you can put in place for a green technology business. You can have defensive IP, offensive IP, and what I call sort of this monitoring competition, which is somewhat of an overlap between defensive and offensive IP. So let's take a little bit more close look at what we mean by defensive patents. Defensive patents are patents that exclude others from practicing your technology. They allow you to exclude others. So you need to establish that protection, and you need to strengthen that protection. You need to put on the hat of your competitors so that you know as a competitor, what are your competitors going to do to try to design around what you're trying to do? How can you keep your competitors out? Offensive patents, on the other hand, are patents that may not necessarily cover what you're doing, but they're going to exclude others from practicing their technology. So really what you're trying to do here is blocking competition. Again, this gets into the business strategy. What is your competitors doing? How can you go about blocking what they're doing? It's important to think about the potential of complementing the portfolio of a potential acquirer so that you can position yourself as a startup for being acquired by somebody else. Next, a little bit more on the defensive strategy. This is very important to consider your products as both complete and discrete assets. Think about the solar industry. There are various components of the solar companies, and depending on what your business strategy is and what you're selling, what it is that you're going to sell, you want to make sure that you cover the various components of it. Think about system claims and system components. In the biofuels area, think about method claims, method of producing the biofuel, downstream uses of the biofuel. Again, think about the business strategy. It's very important that your IP plan parallels the R&D plan. Often, companies end up with some product at the end of the day that is very different from where they started, and it doesn't look anything like it. So it's important to be thinking as you write your patent applications about how the product may morph, how the product may change through time so that you can cover it. What are the tweaks? What are the slight changes that are going to happen as that product goes forward? So in that way, you need to make sure that your patent filings are up to date, so that make sure that you cover any likely commercial candidates that are coming through for the products going forward. All right, further on the defensive strategy, it's very important that you get protection for the company's products themselves. For any company, particularly at the startup level, one of the most critical questions that gets asked is, do you have protection for your product? And the way you get that is by communicating with your IP attorney. It's very important that your IP attorney understands that business. What is it that the green technology business is all about? What are you selling? Are you going to be selling an enzyme for a biofuels company? Are you going to be selling fuel at the end of the day? Are you going to be selling some component? What are your markets? Make sure you educate your employees so that they can identify patentable material. What is it that they're working on that may be patentable? Make certain that you educate your employees about preventing potential loss of rights. Particularly at the startup level, you have companies that are running around talking to others about their great ideas and things that are going on. Make certain that you've educated your employees to know that they can't disclose this stuff without some sort of confidentiality agreement in place. It's very, very important to do so. Make certain that your employees know about maintaining the strategy. Keep that strategy in place. All right, continuing on in the defensive strategy. It's very important to go back to your business strategy and understand where your competitors may be selling, where your competitors may be manufacturing, and where you may be selling. What are the countries of interest? If you're in the biofuel space, you got to be thinking about Brazil. You need to be thinking about China, protecting there. How are you going to go about protecting in those particular regions? In the solar industry, again, China is an area that you need to think about protecting. Going back to the business strategy, who's going to be manufacturing this stuff? Where is it going to be coming from? It's very important as you go through your portfolio to make sure that you fill in gaps that you may have in respect to claim coverage as you look at your portfolio and you develop it, particularly thinking about method claims. Think about process claims. You know, you may have a biofuels company that you're developing. You may think, okay, I'm going to have an enzyme that allows me to convert A to B, a key component in the process of making a certain biofuel. But at the end of the day, that biofuel is going to be made offshore and then imported, put on a ship or something, and shipped into the United States. Right? Think about a method claim that allows you to protect producing A to B so that under the Process Patent Amendment Act, you can get coverage for those activities in the United States. So that a U.S. patent claim would cover a method claim, a method of producing a particular biofuel using one of your components would be infringed. So as you do that, as you draft your patent claims as well, think about your competitors. How are they going to design around your claims? Look at the design around possibilities. On the offensive strategy, remember what we're talking about when we think about offensive strategy. Here we're not necessarily trying to cover our own products, but we're trying to cover our competitors' products. So understanding the competitive landscape is key. Again, back to my original comment in terms of communication within the company. When you hire business development individuals who go out and are marketing and understanding what the competitor is doing, it's very important that information gets brought back to the company, conveyed to the IP team, so that you can go about drafting claims that would cover these competitors. You need to have an offensive strategy that puts you in a position to stop or block your competitors. You need to anticipate where your competitors are going. Again, this information that is gathered by your business development people and others in your company who bring it back to the company is very, very important. It's also important to take a look at your old patent disclosures vis-a-vis this new information that's coming in. It's quite possible that some of your earlier filings anticipated some of this, these new inventions that are coming out by your competitors. And you can go back and write claims that would cover that. So just because your old patent applications were directed to something that you were doing, you may have written something in there, hopefully broadly enough, that would cover what your competitors are now trying to do. So you can go back and take a look at those claims, take a look at the specifications, and write claims that would cover what those competitors are doing. Again, back to the concept of complementing the portfolio of a potential acquirer. This is something to think about when you're working for or representing a small startup. Ultimately, the play will be that this small startup will like to be acquired. So think about your acquirers and what it is that they're doing. Try to complement what they're doing in your terms of your portfolio. This may help you to differentiate yourself from others who are also attempting to be acquired, and may help with leverage in terms of the valuation of your company. It's very important in the green tech and green technology space to be monitoring your competition. As I'm sure many of you have read, there's this huge rush to the patent office right now where people are filing on many, many applications related to green technology. It's important for your companies to monitor this competition, monitor what they're doing, both in terms of what's going on out in the public and also what's going on at the patent office. What are they talking about at these conferences? What are they doing? And then what are their patent applications and where are they going? This allows you to frame both your offensive and defensive strategy. It's important for you to figure out who your competitors are. Who are they? What are they doing? What are they going and what are they doing? It's very important to monitor their patent applications as well. Once again, communication here is absolutely critical. You need to be able to have this information flowing from your employees through the various channels within the company so that this information gets conveyed to your IP folk. It's important also to monitor non-patent literature. Not only patent literature is important, but understand what's going on out there in either by universities or other people who are publishing. This helps you identify the scope of the prior art, which allows you to craft claims which distinguish it. It also helps you identify areas of interest and where the technology is going. This is particularly important in the green technology space where things are there's money flowing in at this stage, and there's lots of new inventions, lots of new things going forward. So important as you draft your claims to understand this art, to understand what's out there, so you can draft patentable claims from the get-go. All right. How do you go about implementing your green technology IP strategy? It's very important to form an IP committee. That IP committee needs to meet on a regular basis. I think it's essential that your IP committee include people that understand the technology within the company. You also need to have some of these business development folks on that IP committee, the folks that are out there that are marketing your technology and understanding what your competitor's doing. You also need decision makers on that IP committee, folks that can actually decide what we're going to file on, why we're filing on it. It's important, too, that this committee has a means by which you can review and track invention disclosures so that you can make effective patent filing decisions. It's important for this committee to review and track third-party patents and consider strategies for those third-party patents. Do you need to think about requesting an interference? copying those claims. Again, in this green technology space, there's so many patents and patent applications that are coming out in this space that you got to monitor it and understand what's going on so you can decide and make creative decisions about what's the best way to deal with these things. Decide, as this information flows into your IP strategy committee, the competitors' information. It's very important to understand where the competitors are going, what their products are, what are they developing, so that you can consider a strategy. What is it you're going to do about it when your chief competitor has a product that's in a space that directly competes with you? That goes back to our business strategy. If the business strategy is, I want to increase my market share, and I've got IP that may cover one of my competitor's products, then you need to think about enforcement. You know, one of the keys, I think, in developing a patent portfolio is that you must think about enforcement. Too often companies, as they build and develop their patent portfolios, are a bit leery or afraid to enforce those patents. If you're leery and afraid to enforce those patents, your competitors are going to understand that and view that that's a part of your strategy, and they're not going to be afraid of you, and they're going to go forward. You need to have the club of enforcement behind those patents, particularly in this green technology space. If you're just willing to sit back and allow your patents to be infringed, then you're never going to be able to truly develop and enforce that IP strategy. Back again to reviewing that business strategy. If your business strategy is evolving, the IP committee needs to understand that. Business strategies are changing all the time. Then you need to review and revise that IP strategy regularly and correspondingly. You need to understand where the company is going and why it's going there, and need to go back and take a look at that IP strategy. Does it still make sense? We're now thinking about selling in a new market. Well, do we have protection in that area? Well, can we get protection in that area? And I think it's important also that your IP strategy get conveyed back to those who are helping to develop the business strategy. Again, the key here is communication. It's essential that all employees are on board with the strategies. Those developing the business strategy and those developing the IP strategy need to be talking to each other. They need to be communicating so that effective IP, your strategy, your IP strategy can be effective and go forward. So I will now pass the baton on to Victor, who will continue this presentation.
Hi, thanks, Michael. Again, I'm Victor Cardona, and I'll be speaking relative to patent prosecution with Green Inventions, and most particularly relative to speeding up the patent process the best we can using some of the PTO's new possibilities. First, I'd like to talk about patent prosecution in general for those who aren't intimately involved with this on a daily basis. At the center of our screen here, we have the scroll, which is representing the patent that we're trying to get. The first step in getting this patent is to file an application. The PTO is then going to provide us with a first off section, which is a letter which tells us, informs us of any deficiencies that we have with our patent application, which is on the right side of your screen. We then would be have an opportunity to respond to that off section with a first response, which amends and or argues against the PTO's comments. We would then get a second and often final office action from the PTO, which again tells us what we've done wrong or what prior art, more probably, they believe prevents us from getting the claims that we desire. After that, our application is going to be allowed or rejected, which is shown by our yellow arrow there. We hope for an allowance. Usually it's not going to happen this quick. We could appeal, which is represented up at the top left there, or we could give up on the application is an alternative represented by our garbage can. The figure that you have there shows a circular process, and what typically happens is down at the second response phase, we'll file a request for continued examination with an appropriate fee, which allows us to just keep the prosecution of the application alive. So So that's prosecution in a nutshell. So the question is, do we accelerate our patent application? Why or why not? To enforce a patent application against a potential infringer, we need to have that patent application granted as a patent. So if we're able to accelerate the patent application, that puts us in a quicker position to enforce any granted patent against an infringer. A problem with accelerating our patent application is that that also accelerates our prosecution costs, and sometimes our clients are not as keen to have that happen. For example, our startup sometimes would like to defer our patent application costs as long as possible. Our investors sometimes have an opinion one way or another on acceleration. Often an investor or a VC would be satisfied if we have a patent application on file, but there may be times and opportunities where they would want us to accelerate our patent applications because we may have a potential infringer out there. Okay, how do we accelerate our prosecution before the PTO? Number one, we could just hope for the best, which has not worked on most occasions.
Hey, Victor.
Yep.
I hate to interrupt you. I wonder if you could speak up and or press *55 on your phone for me to increase your volume. Okay.
Okay, so we can hope for the best. We have the new PTO Green Tech Acceleration Pilot Program, which is going to be the bulk of our talk today. We also have the Peer-to-Patent Program, our First Action Interview Pilot Program, which is recently enhanced. We have the SWAP Program, the Patent Prosecution Highway, the Accelerated Exam Procedure, which was introduced a few years ago, and then we have a petition based on an inventor's age or health, which is a long-standing possibility. Okay, what are we trying to do here with the Green Tech Acceleration Pilot Program? Our goal is, according to the PTO, is to reduce prosecution time by about 1 year. The first 3,000 applications are going to be allowed into this program. Average prosecution at this time is about 30 months to a first office action and about 40 months to a final decision. So if we're able to take 1 year off of that, that's a good thing in most situations. There's also an estimate that there's 25,000 pending eligible applications. 12,000 of these were filed in 2009, so 3,000 applications is a pretty small percentage of that possibility. And again, there's a one-year time frame to actually get in on this process as of now. Okay, how do we do it? There's subject matter eligibility, which, as you imagine, relates to green tech inventions, and we'll speak a little bit about that later. We need to pay an early publication fee of $300, and we need to do this even if our patent application has already been published. There's a claim number restriction. We need to agree to phone election of invention or species. There's no petition fee, and we need to file electronically, which most of us are doing now for most of our PTO correspondence anyway. Okay, now what does accelerated exam get for us? It gets special status, which puts us on the examiner's special docket, which advances the application out of turn to get to the examiner's desk. So that's where that one-year time frame comes in. We're hoping to save a year up front. After the application has been looked at, it goes to the examiner's amended docket, which is any other application which has been amended. And during any appeal process, we also get special status, where the application gets advanced out of turn toward the top of the examiner's stack. Publication is also accelerated due to this process. And which applications qualify? It has to be a pending application, no first office action. It can't be a reissue. It must be a non-provisional application. And it can be a 371 national stage application as long as it was filed before the December 8, 2009 start date of the program. What about our claims? We need three or less independent, 20 or less total. We cannot have multiply dependent claims. We can only have one invention. And we can amend the claims by preliminary amendment to get to these thresholds. What subject matter is going to apply? We have environmental quality, renewable energy, energy efficiency, and greenhouse gas reduction. And despite these categories, an application has to be classified into specific patent classifications. There's a bunch of them listed up there now. This is the alternative energy production classifications. If an application is already been classified and it does not fall into any of the classifications listed under the program, it can't enter the program. But we can file a preliminary amendment to change our claims, hoping to get it to fall now within this classification. We could do that, amend our claims, and we can even suggest the classification. Unfortunately, the PTO does not have to accept our classification. If our application has not yet been classified, we can also suggest the classification. However, as said before, the PTO does not need to accept that classification. Here's some energy conservation classifications, some environmentally friendly farming classifications, which was a surprise to me. Here we have some pollution remediation types of classifications. Okay, we also need to make a statement in our petition that, in this case, our application materially enhances the quality of the environment by contributing to the restoration or maintenance of the basic life-sustaining natural elements as listed there. There's a similar requirement relative to the others, renewable energy, reduction of energy consumption, and greenhouse gas reduction. If we look at renewable energy resources, some examples of technologies which are going to fall into this include solar, wind, hydroelectric, renewable biomass, landfill gas, ocean energy production, and some related to those. As far as the energy consumption, energy reduction, we could reduce energy in combustion systems, industrial equipment, and household appliances. Relative to greenhouse gas emissions, nuclear power qualifies, along with fossil fuel power generation technologies, which somehow reduce greenhouse gases. An example could be carbon sequestration and capture. Okay, if our application is not clear on its face that it materially enhances, as we just discussed, we need to file a supplemental statement explaining how it does. And our statement can't speculate how a potential end user could use the invention to meet this qualification. It can't relate to any minor aspects of the invention. And the PTO has also posted on its website that they strongly recommend that we file the statement regardless of how clear we think our application is, because they state that it could be that the PTO examiner looking at it would not think things are as clear as we think they are. If our petition is not sufficient when we first file it, we can be given a one-month time period to correct it. It's important that we try to get this correct even before this one-month time period, because our application does not enter the program. It doesn't become one of those 3,000 applications until the PTO gets a properly filed petition. So if we file it and it's not correct, we're not going to get in the program until after we correct it during this one-month time period. Restriction practice, as I indicated briefly, the PTO examiner is going to call. We must elect the species or invention by telephone. We can't traverse it. If the PTO examiner can't get in touch with us, he's going to pick the first claimed invention from the list of claims that we file. Okay, that's the end of our Green Tech Acceleration Program. I'm going to just go through some of the others, which a Clean Tech patent application owner could use. This is the Peer-to-Patent Program, and this relates more to computer arts. There are a few Clean Tech-related applications in the program, not many. This program closed in July 2009 as far as for new applications. There's a chance it could be restarted. The idea behind this one was that an applicant volunteered to participate in this collaboration via a third-party website. After the collaboration by peers who would send references to this website, the top 10 were sent to the PTO. After those top 10 were sent to the PTO, the application would get moved at a turn such that it would be on that special docket, the same as the Green Tech program. Okay, here's the interview pilot program, which has been enhanced. Again, this is restricted to particular art units. There are a few that a clean tech invention could qualify under potentially. There's no acceleration in the original waiting time. The idea behind this is that it's going to get accelerated once it hits the examiner's desk via further back and forth between the applicant and the examiner. Now, again, we need to reduce our claims to 3 and 20. We're only supposed to have one invention. And the examiner is going to issue a pre-interview communication, which either allows the application or provide some references and some rejections for the applicant to respond to within a one-month time period. So the options for responding to this communication are to waive the interview, say we don't want the interview, it's going to result in an office action from the PTO. We could respond to the communication and thereby also waive the interview, schedule an interview, provide arguments and or amendments to facilitate the discussion. Which seems the most likely possibility. If an applicant just fails to respond, that's also going to result in an office action. Okay, possible outcomes of such an interview: allowance, which would be a good thing. We could, after the discussions, the PTO examiner could give a first office action with a shortened response time, which seems like the best outcome. Alternatively, an applicant could reply to the first interview communication as if it were a first office action, and the PTO would then issue a quick second office action. The only advantage of this would be if an applicant wanted to get right to appeal, he was convinced he was right, presumably the second office action would be final, and they could proceed right to an appeal. Okay, here's the swap program. If a small entity has two applications on file, he can abandon one and the other one gets put to the top of the examiner's pile. There are limited opportunities when this would be advantageous, I would think, but there may be some where there's an application that an applicant just wants to get examined, even if he needs to abandon another application. Some other acceleration options are the patent prosecution highway. There are several countries which participate in this, including the EPO, the UK, Finland, Australia, Denmark, Germany, Japan, Korea, Singapore, and Canada. Under this program, if a corresponding patent application is granted in one of these countries, the corresponding claims in the U.S. application could get fast-tracked relative to their examination in response to the granting of the patent abroad. We also have the accelerated examination, which was introduced a few years ago. This accelerated program is designed to get a patent within a year. It requires quite a bit of work on behalf of the applicant, including doing his own search, providing examination support document, and conducting interviews with the examiner on a regular basis. This could result in a lot of admissions, and there's a lot of complications with this program. Much simpler program is if your inventor is over 65, you can file a petition based on his or her age, which, again, will result in advancement of the application. Okay, on to green tech or clean tech patent prosecution. Many of these technologies are in crowded fields, some of which are the legacy of the 70s renewable energy push, and there's just a lot of crowded prior art in many of these fields. It's not the internet in the late 90s when things were wide open, and there were a lot of pioneer patents, and there was just no prior art to use. It's definitely more constrained. Due to the newness and the money flowing into this area, there are a lot of startups with limited funds, and sometimes there's a tension between their desire for broad claim coverage and their desire to conserve cash. And that, a lot of times, is going to drive your prosecution, just the general cost factor. Again, there's also big companies like GE, Siemens, and the car companies, which are putting a lot of money into this area and a lot of attorney time. The technologies themselves vary. For example, solar technology, you've got some older technologies like the solar thermal trough technologies, which are utilized to boil water and turn steam turbines, which may have less innovation and less open innovation than some of the thin film PV and third generation PV technologies. Similarly, in wind, the large-scale wind turbine market is a bit more mature, whereas the small-scale residential and urban wind turbines, there's more innovation and there may be more opportunity for broader patents. Similar to all other technologies, the KSR decision has constrained us a bit relative to obviousness. We've got crowded prior art, and the PTO is more than willing to combine references, which a few years ago they wouldn't have, and that's definitely constrained us. There's also, in the last 6 months or so, I've seen a bit more interaction with the examiners. They appear to be a bit more willing to be proactive and let us know when they see something which is patentable, and this may be the legacy of the new PTO director switching away from the mindset that rejection equals quality. Instead, the PTO examiner, PTO director, excuse me, is saying that the applicant should get whatever subject matter he's entitled to via the patent law. So there is a little more movement in that area. And in summary, we've talked about some ways to accelerate if desired by the applicant. Relative to prosecution itself, the strategy really depends on the size of the applicant and how crowded the prior art field is, and this is varying based on the technology and the subfields within the technology. And with that, I'd like to pass the baton to Paul Davis, who will speak to us relative to IP enforcement strategies.
Thank you. We're in an interesting era now because traditional enforcement is fairly straightforward, but there are some issues relating to the whole concept of climate change and how that impacts intellectual property protection for clean tech. And when you look at the data from the EPA, it shows that patent applications for environmental technologies have rapid growth, actually, from 1998. Patent applications for new energy innovations grew by more than 6% per year, which is quite a bit. And in the space, wind, fuel, solar, thermal, photovoltaic have shown the strongest growth since the 90s, and you find a lot of funding in those areas, obviously. The U.S., Germany, Japan, and the Netherlands have the highest number of applications in the new energy sector. Now, in October, the Geneva and Washington-based Coalition for Innovation, Employment, and Development released a study that warned that weakening of intellectual property rights in carbon clean technology could likely dampen innovation in Europe and especially would result in the loss of European jobs. And according to the coalition, IP rights are necessary, obviously, for for European firms to undertake investments, the investment capital needed in R&D for clean tech. And as with any investment, if the risk of the return increases, firms will tend and this could cause serious compliance in reaching greenhouse reduction targets and reduce opportunities for job creation in Europe. Under licensing, the rationale obviously behind licensing is to protect one's investment. Patents and IP rights protect an entity's investment and are directly tied to innovation, and it permits entities to invest more in R&D without the fear that another company will come in and take that technology and then market it at less cost because they didn't have to make that investment. More than 70% of the global R&D in green tech is spent by private companies that want to protect their investments, which is quite a number. For example, Toyota has patented more than 1,000 systems and components on its third-generation Prius hybrid car, which is outstanding. Under traditional licensing, there is one alternative proposal to traditional licensing, and that's establishment of an international licensing mechanism that's focused on green tech and clean tech. This already happens in the case of certain technologies, from engine components to airliners. However, if the common good and the issue of climate change are kept in mind, the licensing of green tech needs to include some sort of fee mechanism. This would enable economies at different stages of development, such as the United States, China, and Bangladesh, to use the same licensed technologies to promote sustainability and clean tech. Reduce global warming. However, if the basic goal in mind of climate change are to be kept in mind, licensing of clean tech needs to include some sort of fee mechanism at the very least. And I'm talking now about if there are compulsory licensings or things of that nature. So there has to be some sort of compensation. So we have licensing. There are proposals for licensing with various fee mechanisms, and so any new green licensing proposal should focus on established non-cutting-edge or proof-of-concept technologies. I mean, if you think about it, in solar, in thin-film solar, if there were a new material science developed, that would certainly be cutting-edge, and that would have a great impact on the profitability of or the efficiency of solar and have a tremendous economic impact. Now, parallel to this, we have international agreements that should increasingly encourage joint development of green tech by firms from developed and developing economies, and examples of this already exist. For example, Vestas, which is the world's largest wind turbine manufacturer, sources 90% of its components for its new turbines from Chinese companies, and in turn, the turbine is manufactured in China's Inner Mongolia autonomous region so that it can easily reach the Chinese market. And there exists a licensing mechanism which allows for the spread of established green tech today, which helps developing countries to act on national environmental strategies and allows them to protect innovations and investors in advanced economies. So what we have going now is developing a broader green IP framework, and that's very important to the success of international climate treaties and emission reduction standards. It is also crucial for developing countries, which would typically bear the brunt of the projected increase because of what they currently do with coal, et cetera. With extreme weather events and with warming, so the international climate change negotiations taking place under the United Nations could erode this position of corporation holding patents on existing and future technology. So we have these competing interests relative to protecting IP for clean tech and climate control. So IP rights are you know, there's great discussions about how IP rights are tied to climate control. And so the question is, should developing countries in implementing climate control be entitled to share IP rights owned by third parties? And then one has to make a decision as to which technologies could be shared and on what terms. And that's a great area of contention amongst countries. For example, many green technologies and innovations have dual use. And I would cite as an example new materials that may be developed for solar. Those semiconductor materials obviously go way beyond solar and into many other different things, chip designs, things of that nature. So one would have to be very cautious about if those were licensable or granted to third world countries at little or no cost, how far those would extend. So you have a basic question is, though, what is green technology? I mean, it's a term today that is used widely. So now talking about climate control, there's a group of 77 countries, and it's headed by China. This is the largest intergovernmental organization of developing states in the United Nations, and it actually covers 130 countries since being formed in 64, and it tries to promote economic interests within the United Nations system. China and India claim that developing countries are primarily responsible for climate change, and so Europe and the U.S. should support poor nations by providing them with clean technologies. And I would argue that China is more than a developing country. It was one of the leading world economies, as does India. Also, it should be noted that India, you cannot get patents on nuclear, and nuclear is coming back into vogue, particularly in Europe. So the technology transfer issue has emerged in recent months as one of the significant issues at the UN climate talks. So this group of 77, primarily through China and India, have suggested that the green technology should be subject to compulsory licensing. And developing nations led by this group in China are proposing a wide-ranging system to allow poor nations to adapt to global warming and limit their emissions. And then there's a related framework, which is India's clean tech proposal for the creation of an international network of clean tech R&D centers for developing nations and least developed countries. India's proposal, which has received a great deal of support from many of these G77 nations, cites as a precedent the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research, an institution that was created by the World Bank and the United Nations in the early 70s and that now includes 15 international crop research centers. To date, much of the tech transfer discussions have centered on some sort of means of financing this process, either through the proposal by the G77 in China for a multi-billion-dollar fund, or through wealthy nations' desires to provide some financing through a cap-and-trade system, or through voluntary contributions. Compulsory licensing to date has only been used in emergency situations where patent-protected pharmaceuticals were seen as prohibitively expensive, and that brings to mind the HIV medicaments that are subject to compulsory licensing. So the Coalition for Innovation, Employment, and Development is a think tank and strongly in favor of IP rights, and it's published a report showing that ending patent prosecution on clean tech would pose a great threat to industry and job creation and actually on innovation. And they've come back with an analysis that shows a strong IP system supports the development of green tech and probably the creation of over 2 million jobs in Europe over the next 20 years. The effects of compulsory licensing could be really quite outstanding. Some view it as a doomsday scenario. The highest profile examples of compulsory licensing, as I said, have come from the pharmaceutical industry. But the situation there was pharmaceuticals were already a major industry with major significant revenues when the compulsory licensing went into effect. And in contrast, clean energy is emerging and does not have nearly the kind of revenue streams that big pharma has. So compulsory licensing could make it more difficult for startups to raise funds, startups can find themselves entering what's called a valley of death a lot sooner, running out of capital before they ever get off the ground. So some kind of framework for establishing clean tech IP was discussed in Copenhagen in December. Nothing's been concluded. And so that continues to be an ongoing discussion and negotiation. In developing countries, some believe that the developing countries will need clean technologies if they're going to play any active role in climate change. And the question is how to access these. It's been proposed that compulsory licensing is one option, but many new and more flexible compulsory licensing schemes will be necessary for clean tech, especially given the potential demand in developing countries and the short time to implement that. Individual countries could unilaterally use World Trade Organization rules for compulsory licensing to access key technologies, but that in any new licensing system should only be needed if industrial nations fail to meet the tech transfer and financing commitments under the UN framework. And some proponents of new compulsory licensing for climate-related technologies misunderstand the key differences between access to medicines debate that went under the TRIPS agreements and tech transfer under UNFCCC. TRIPS concerns just one relatively weak commitment to technology transfer that only refers to at least developing countries, and the UNFCCC addresses it extensively and it provides clear guidelines, especially on financing. There are many other factors that compulsory licensing may not resolve. For example, many climate technologies such as micro, hydroelectric, wind and solar, the major cost is not IP, but the actual hardware and maintenance. So it's going to be more than just access to IP on some of these very significant technologies. I'm going to skip over this next one and go to the next one. So under the UNFCC, industrialized countries, what they're proposing is are committed to providing and financing technology transfer regardless of patents. They are obligated to make available funds and to ensure that this takes place. There is the Montreal Protocol, which also accounts for IP market failures where patented goods or knowledge become unaffordable for many relevant consumers. So under them, developed countries guarantee to transfer technologies, including paying for licenses. And if the technology exists and is unavailable in a national market at an affordable cost. And unlike compulsory licensing, this commitment represents a cooperative approach. And so that's significant. So those engaged in the current UNFCCC negotiations are very much aware that agreeing to a workable mechanism for tech transfer is essential. It's going to be crucial for strategies to successfully combat climate change after 2012, when the first commitment period for the Kyoto Protocol ends. There are alternatives to compulsory licensing, and one is that instead of compulsory licensing, often that's been used for drug makers, one can subsidize licensing for green tech, and the idea is to have developing countries pay a small portion of licensing costs for key technologies, and have various large, the U.S. government and other governments make up the difference, and have developed countries transfer financial funds to the poorer nations. Now, where all this is going to go, who knows? It's a great debate, huge debate. Now we'll go into more traditional methods of enforcement. You certainly have litigation, and you've got to decide where you're going to file the infringement suit. For example, maybe you're in solar, or manufacturing in China. Are you going to file in China? Are you going to file it in the U.S.? Can you get injunctive relief? What are the damages? Currently, patent infringement damages are calculated by giving equal weight to a variety of factors. You have the entire market rule, which is a tool in the court's damages toolbox today. The entire market rule allows for damages award based upon the full value of the patented technology, which can be quite substantial. That's my presentation, and I'll hand it off, and if anyone has any questions, I think they're going to be taken now.
All right. Well, thank you, Michael, Victor, and Paul, for sharing your expertise with us today. And before we start our live and interactive Q&A session, let me make a brief announcement about the New York attorney participants who wish to get credit for New York State. You must record the following CLE verification code on your attendance register in order to obtain credits. That code is TLU, the numeral 7, AE. That's T as in Tango, L as in Lima, U as in Uniform, 7, A as in Alpha, E as in Echo. TLU 7, AE. Also, if you're listening to a recorded version and wish to obtain Connecticut CLE credits, you must also record the same CLE verification code. Now on to our question and answer session. Listeners can ask our speakers any questions relevant to today's topics. You may email your questions to iplaw@straffordpub.com, or you can use the chat feature at the lower left corner of the computer and chat your questions to us and click the blue icon beside the box once you've entered your question. Or you can dial in using the instructions on the screen. Simply press star 1 to enter the question queue. And if for any reason you decide not to ask your question, you can press star 1 again to exit the question queue. And after you press star 1, when it's your turn, our operator Joanne will announce the first name and city for the person registered at your location. And if you'd like to identify yourself further at that time, please do so. So while we wait for the phone lines, we do have one question already that we received by chat. And the first question is, for the offensive patent strategy, do you have any comments with respect to the risk of being viewed as being anti-competitive? And Michael, I believe you addressed that issue.
Interesting question. Eric, can you hear me?
I hear you.
Okay, great. The risk of being viewed as anti-competitive. You know, patents, by their nature, are an exchange. That is an exchange between the inventors and the government, the patent office. By disclosing their ideas and their inventions, the government gives them the exclusive right to exclude others from practicing whatever their invention is. So the you know, by focusing on your competitors rather than your own sort of IP, are you in some way being viewed as anti-competitive? And I would say no. I think that, you know, it's important that, you know, IPs are a value driver in building the value of a company. And in doing so, you know, business is competitive. So in that sense, I mean, I would say it is competitive. I don't see how that a company, by developing and building its own IP, is being anti-competitive. But I think it's something that if you're in the IP game, to leave out your competitors and simply focus on your own IP, I think you're missing a huge area of potential value that you could add to your company. So it's kind of a long-winded circular answer, but I think I get where the question is coming from, and I think it's that's my response. I'd be curious what the other speakers, how they would respond to that.
Victor and Paul?
Well, you know, I don't think it is anti-competitive. I mean, there are, you know, our whole patent system is based upon full disclosure on how to make the invention so that one will then improve upon it. And so it really promotes innovation, and it actually is, I think, just quite the antithesis of, you know, of those issues. I think it promotes things. And occasionally we get some really huge hits, like, you know, just things that are so novel that everybody has to have, and that would occur perhaps with some new with material science, particularly like with solar, but that hasn't happened yet.
Okay. Well, oh, go ahead. Victor, did you have a comment?
No, that's fine. I don't have anything to add.
Okay. Again, folks, we got a great opportunity with three experts here, so please call in and take advantage of them while you got them. We don't have any additional chatted questions right now, so let me ask you this. Considering that we are just crossed the line into 2010, and I'll just sort of direct this question to each of you, let each of you comment. What do you kind of give us a brief reflection on what happened in 2009, and then give us your forecast for any changes in this area for 2010?
I guess I'll start since I didn't respond to the last one. This is Victor. I think, well, we all know what happened with the economy last year and the financial stimulus by the government. I think there was a lot of holding back to see where that money was going to go and how it was going to affect the clean tech sector. I think some of that money is going to find its way into some IP this year, and some of those that have been holding back to see where that money was going to go are now going to pursue their own opportunities independent of that.
This is Paul Davis. I see 2009 versus 2010, you're going to have increased funding by venture firms. You're going to have more opportunities. It's still going to be very constrained, though. There's a lot of solar plays out. There's a lot of different clean tech plays out there. What you see today, though, is between 2009, there was a great amount of emphasis on the smart grid, and that is taking place, and we're going to really see that being implemented in 2010, moving forward. I've got clients that are in that space, and there's all kinds of money out there for the smart grid.
This is Michael. It's interesting to be a year later from 2009, because a year ago I would say there was extreme paralysis out there. It was a scary time, and a number of clients were just sort of frozen, and the industry, the money, everything seemed to stop. But once the Obama came in at the end of January, I mean, there was, at least in my practice and in our firm, there seemed to be a people sort of relaxed, and there seemed to be okay, we're here, and things started to pick up and take off. And I a couple of comments on there's a huge government grants program that went into place, and it's interesting to see how that money has been spent and where it's gone. And there unfortunately have not been a lot of grants that have been set out. And from what I've heard, there's a bit of concern and fear from those handing out the money that they don't want to just hand it out to anyone, for fear of having the $600 toilet of years and years ago when making certain that it's a success, that the money goes to an entity that's got to be successful. So the money is not flowing out of the government like perhaps it was hoped to be. And when you talk to the VCs out here in the Valley, out in Silicon Valley, about that, and when you hear their perspective on, okay, this money, is this money really going to be there? Is it really going to flow? And most of them pause and stop and say, well, it may be there at the end of the day, but we cannot wait for it. We're gonna go forward with our funding of entities. We're gonna move forward. We're not gonna rely on the government, and so that from it's sort of the classic Silicon Valley approach to these things is we're gonna do it, and you're seeing that, and things are moving forward, with a little bit of leasing and loosening of the money. And so that's a good thing. So I see 2010 as sort of let's go forward, and the money will start to flow to good ideas.
Okay, I think one of you referred to the smart grid in your answer. We had a question come in. What's the smart grid?
The smart grid is our actual grid dates back to FDR days in the 1930s, and it is just not efficient. So the smart grid really is the management of transmission of energy, of electrical energy to homes, etc. And our system today is just way behind the time. So there's it's not efficient. There's a great loss of efficiency, energy, etc. So the Obama administration has really emphasized the smart grid, where that you have a lot of software solutions for power transmission management and efficiency.
Okay. All right. Here's another question. What is the relevance of Bilski to green technology patents? And if one of you would, please explain Bilski briefly for us. But not everybody wants.
Well, it's kind of complicated, but this is Victor. Bilski's before the Supreme Court now, as we all know, and it relates to software patents, mostly software and business methods. It's probably going to relate mostly to those patents, which maybe the smart grid, as we talked about, that's one example where maybe not the hardware, but there could be some software inventions which could be affected. I guess it remains to be seen in what way. But your typical products relating to solar, wind, et cetera, are probably not going to be affected by that one. I'm personally more concerned with trying to get around KSR, than Bilski relative to most of the clean tech inventions I'm working on.
And what exactly is KSR? And if you would, I think, is this Victor?
Yes.
Yeah, speak up a little bit more, Victor, or hit that star 55 again. Explain the KSR to us.
KSR mostly has made it easier for patent examiners to combine references which we may have considered previously wouldn't have been related to one another. We used to be able to use arguments like non-analogous art, and this reference does not teach or suggest whatever the examiner has alleged. The KSR decision has made it a lot easier for the PTO to bring somewhat disparate references together and allege that they would make the claims of our pending patent applications obvious.
Okay.
Right. What's happening is it's giving the examiners an out for not allowing cases. You can see three or four references combined, and you know every invention is a combination of components. It simply is, and so you have some examiners that are combining 5, 6, 7 references, which is just insane.
All right, we've got another question, and Victor, this one is actually directed to you. Can Victor comment on how the first action interview is initiated by the applicant? And then second question, what are the dangers of the accelerated exam process, file wrapper, estoppel, et cetera? So the first question, can you comment on how the first action
interview? Yeah, it sounds like the first one is how do you request an interview? And I believe it's just via, there's a PTO form. I think you just file. You may even be able to just call them. They're usually pretty pretty amenable to that, but I did see a particular form that's been used in that particular program, and I think the other one related to the accelerated exam program. For that one, yeah, I guess I'd be most concerned with file wrapper estoppel and what you say, particularly in the examination support document, could be used against you because the PTO is basically asking us to write our own office actions, and I hate to have that stuff used against me later.
What is file wrapper estoppel?
Basically, what you say during the prosecution of a patent application, if you ever try to enforce that patent application, that patent, granted patent hopefully later, anything you say could narrow the scope of your claims, and your potential opponent is more than happy to try to use anything you say against you later on.
Okay. Michael or Paul, do you have any comments on either of those questions?
Well, I always interview most of my cases, at least by phone, because I want to be able to understand where the examiner is coming from, and I really encourage that. And understand what the examiner's position is, and to explain the broader picture in terms of what the innovation, how it relates, et cetera, things of that nature. So I really encourage people to interview their case with the examiners. The examiners have a very limited amount of time to examine, and anything to make their job easier is, you know, really helpful.
Now, this is Michael. I completely agree with Paul. We interview cases all the time as well, and the way we like to do it is to have the inventor or somebody who really understands the technology in on the call or in the face-to-face meeting with the examiner, and let the technical person explain the technology to the examiner. This allows the examiner to get comfortable with the technology. I mean, examiners often don't like patent attorneys. They don't want to deal with them. They'd much prefer to talk technology with a scientist or somebody who really understands the technology, somebody who's more like them. And so if you can get the examiner to understand the technology with the scientist, then the patent attorney can come in later in the interview and say, okay, you now understand we got something here, and let's talk about the claims. How can we craft the claims that can deal with your rejections? And oftentimes the examiners are much more relaxed and much more, okay, I get it, all right, and then they'll come to some sort of agreement. So when we take this strategy back to some of the KSR obviousness issues that Victor was talking about, I think this is a very important way to deal with these things. I mean, the law still is, even though after KSR, that if an examiner is able to set forth a prima facie case of obviousness, you can rebut that case by showing that you've got something that's unexpected. And the law still says that you can do that, set forth those results that show that your invention is unexpected and overcome KSR. And it's, I think, very, very helpful to get your scientist to explain why this invention is so great. So it's not an attorney arguing why it's so great. It's some scientist who relates directly to that examiner and can say, man, this is the greatest thing. Here's why. Here's why this was so unexpected. And you can overcome these KSR problems. So I agree with everything that's been said so far.
And when is the appropriate time to set that up? What's the time lag from the time of your initial application?
Well, you want to do your interview, at least I like to do it, prior to filing the response to the office action.
Okay.
So, so also I can get some feedback from the examiner. Or if I have to, I will do the interview right as the examiner is going to have that response on his or her desk.
All right. Well, believe it or not, we don't have any other questions pending, so hopefully there are a couple other thoughts coming. We still have a few minutes. So let me do this. Were there any areas in your presentations that you may have run through for the sake of time? Because we now have a few minutes if you want to make some comments that you had to skip before. And I guess I'll ask you first, Michael, since you went first.
No, I don't have anything else that I feel I need to add at this point.
Okay. Victor?
I just follow up relative to that interview issue. It's also important to make sure you do that interview at the first office action, because often the examiner won't do it at the second office action. Sometimes you get a nice one that will, but at a final office action, they typically won't even talk to you. So if you're going to do it, make sure you time when you're going to do it, I guess.
All right. Paul?
Yeah, I would totally agree with that statement. You need to do it at the first office action. The second time, the examiner is unlikely to do it, and you're going to wind up filing an RCAA continuing application. With mine, I think, you know, right now with all this debate about clean tech and the environment, I suspect it's going to come down to IP rights will be sustained, but it's something that's fascinating in the sense that China is putting such emphasis on this when the majority of the solar is manufactured in China. So it's an interesting situation.
This is Michael. I think China is something that deserves some further discussion. It still amazes me today as the number of companies and clients who really question about, should I be protecting in China, or what can I do in China, you know, what's going on there. And China is, as we all know, just this incredible engine of innovation and work, and this amount of just stuff, for lack of a better word, that's flowing out of there is just incredible. And to dismiss China from an IP's perspective, to just say, you cannot enforce anything in China, to not take it into a part of your strategy, I think is a huge, huge mistake. There are a number of instances where we're seeing successful enforcement of intellectual property in China, whereas we didn't before. I think the beginning of this started with the Olympics, when the Chinese had their own trademarks, which they started to develop and to protect with respect to their Olympics, and realized that they didn't want other people knocking off their trademarks, and so that the government itself started to enforce and set forth procedures by which IP can be enforced in China. So that's been a real sea change over there, and protecting over there, I think, is very, very important, particularly in the clean tech space.
I totally agree. I mean, I'm recommending to clients, if they have to choose between China and Japan, go to China. You know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, people were concerned about enforcement of IP in Taiwan. And at that time, there really wasn't any formal Taiwanese patent office. What was happening were the inventions were sent out to professors to determine whether or not there was patentable subject matter. As Chinese industry grew, as Taiwanese industry grew and innovation increased, you found very strong IP protection rights in Taiwan, and you will find the same thing in China. So I would certainly concur and go heavily into China.
All right. We do have another chatted question, and the question is, can you elaborate on the Montreal Protocol?
Well, the Montreal, let me go back and see some of my notes here, just a second. Wait a minute. Basically, it's working with the UN, and it is concerned where that you have some significant patented goods and items that are unaffordable, and to countries that are third world nations, etc. So basically, what under that protocol, developed countries would have to guarantee to transfer technologies that would be then unavailable at an affordable cost. And that is not being implemented today with clean tech, but that's a consideration as something that has been implemented in the past. Basically, it's different from compulsory licensing, and whereas this is more of a cooperative approach. It isn't, you know, a mandate that you must do this. It's, all right, guys, let's get together. Let's see if we can work something out. So it's contrasted with compulsory licensing. It is not compulsory.
Okay. Any thoughts on that from the other two gentlemen?
This is Michael. I'd like to ask Paul a follow-up question on compulsory licensing. I remember looking at the issue of compulsory licensing, and it seemed to be really driven by whether or not there was a substitutable substitution, meaning if somebody could be forced to license their IP if there wasn't anything that could substitute for the product. And I'm curious, Paul, what your take is on
Yeah, exactly. The only time compulsory licensing has been implemented is through the HIV drugs,
mm-hmm.
Where there wasn't anything else.
Right.
And also what was significant then is they had compulsory licensing in industries which already had significant revenues. And in clean tech, we don't have significant revenues yet. So compulsory licensing has only been applied where there are ongoing businesses that have had a history of profit-making and that there is no alternative. So there's a huge difference.
All right. Any final thoughts before we wrap up? All right. Well, if not, again, I want to thank Dr. Michael Ward, Paul Davis, and Victor Cardona for sharing their insights and expertise with us today. And I want to thank you. We hope you've enjoyed our national webinar, Patenting Green Technologies, Crafting Patent Claims for Clean Energy Innovations. A webinar evaluation form will be emailed to attendees shortly. Please take a minute to fill out that form and submit it. Let us know how we did today. Listeners who have ordered or wish to order CLE credits must verify their participation in today's conference by submitting the completed attendance register that is part of the conference materials. It's on the handouts page at the top right corner. And we will issue verification of CLE credits as they are granted by the states that accredit webinar events such as this. If you have any questions about CLE credits, please call our CLE service at 404-881-1141, extension 21. Today's participants can order a recorded version of this event at a special attendee price. Please call customer service at 800-926-7926, extension 10, or visit Stratford's website at www.straffordpub.com. And while you're there, please check out information on upcoming Stratford CLEs, including a program entitled Patent Damages After Lucent versus Gateway and Cornell versus HP, Strategies for Establishing or Disproving Infringement Damages. And that's scheduled for Wednesday, February 3rd, 2010, starting at 1 p.m. Eastern, running 90 minutes. Stratford would like to thank you for your attendance. To end this call, simply hang up the phone. Thank you and goodbye.